May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Ruzica, and I represent the defendant, Mr. Sammy Natur. I'd like to spend the bulk of my time this morning discussing the constructive amendment issue. Before I do, however, I'd like to address the being in the business enhancement that was applied at sentencing because we think that the errors made there were clear. In the event that Mr. Natur's conviction is not reversed, his sentence should be vacated and remanded because the district court both procedurally and substantively erred in making its alleged findings at sentencing regarding whether Mr. Natur was in the business of selling and receiving stolen property. At best, the district court discussed the issue of whether Mr. Natur was in the business twice at the sentencing hearing. At first, Mr. Natur's counsel stated that he would rest on the arguments he made in his version of the offense, and the judge simply said, "Well, I reject your argument," and then moved on immediately to a discussion about his criminal history. Procedurally, this conclusion is not enough for this court to be able to do its job in reviewing Mr. Natur's sentence. Now, arguably, the district court did revisit this issue later on in the hearing. At the bottom of page 38 of the sentencing transcript, which is at page 135 of the supplemental appendix, the court says, "Let me go back and make sure that I didn't jump too quickly on the issues, on that other issue." So it's really not clear that we're addressing being in the business. But the court goes on to say that theft is a huge problem, that there were quite a number of phones involved here, and that he could have had a legitimate business and still be in the business of selling and receiving the stolen property. However, the court never came out and directly found that he was in the business of selling and receiving stolen property, and that's where we get into the substantive errors that were made at sentencing. Assuming that these two discussions about being in the business were sufficient to afford this court meaningful review, the evidence considered at the sentencing hearing did not establish that he was in the business of selling or receiving stolen property. This enhancement only applies to a particular subset of offenders who are professional fences, and it applies the totality of the circumstances test. Under the application notes of the sentencing guidelines, there are four primary factors that are to be considered. Of these factors, it's clear from the record that three do not apply to Mr. Natur. The record shows that Mr. Natur did not maintain an inventory of stolen property. The government admitted that none of the phones found in his store were, in fact, stolen. The stock that was found by the government was found to be legitimate. There also was no issue of other crimes here. There's no allegation that Mr. Natur's activities encouraged or facilitated other crimes, and this is his first offense involving stolen property. The only factor that could potentially be at issue here is the regularity and sophistication of Mr. Natur's activities. The government conceded that Mr. Natur's activities took place over the course of a very short one-month period of time. The court even acknowledged this when it said that Mr. Natur got caught quickly. Further, there's no evidence in the record to suggest that Mr. Natur was running a sophisticated operation. He was buying these phones from other people. He was shipping them in his name under a FedEx account that was connected back to him, and he was accepting checks as payments that could be traced. He wasn't using an alias. There wasn't a separate entity that was created for the transportation of these phones. So this was not a sophisticated operation. Taking these factors one by one, it's clear that Mr. Natur is not in the business of selling and receiving stolen property. He ran a legitimate cell phone business, and that fact should not be confused with the activities for which he was charged. His sentence should accordingly be vacated and remanded with a direction that the two-level increase for the being in the business does not apply in this case. Now, given that, we should not even need to reach these sentencing issues because the indictment here was constructively amended.
What's the harm here if we read stolen broadly enough to reach goods that have been taken by fraud?
The harm here is that Mr. Natur would have been convicted in violation of his Fifth Amendment grand jury right.
Well, that's the conclusion. That's not the question of what the harm was.
Well, the harm really does get to...
Do you think the grand jury would not have indicted him if they'd said stolen, converted, or product of fraud, whatever the third is?
I can't speak to what the grand jury would have done.
Well, use your common sense.
But
if you were a grand juror, would you say, well, if we're stolen or converted, yeah, but just fraud? I don't know.
Well, when you look at...
They don't even know what converted means, do they?
I think it's important here to look at the structure of the charging statute. Mr. Natur was charged under 2314. 2314 applies to three different types of property.
So let me get back to what's the harm. So what difference would it have made in terms of his defense, in terms of the law, in would it have made any difference? And the evidence would have been essentially the same. So I'm trying to figure out what's the harm. I understand your argument that it shouldn't be read broadly. It should be narrowly read, and the constructive amendment would not be appropriate. But can you identify anything in the record or how the case might have changed or his defense might have changed or something if that taken by fraud language had been there?
If the taken by fraud language had been in the indictment, then we would not have the issue that we're presented with here. I think you're raising a more of an issue of notice, and that's a separate right that Mr. Natur had. Here, we're talking specifically about his Fifth Amendment right to have all felony charges passed on by the grand jury. And in this case, that did not happen because of the way the indictment was written. The indictment was written very narrowly.
Well, the statute says stolen, converted, or taken by fraud. Aren't these really synonyms? What's the difference between converted and taken by fraud?
Converted generally refers to a situation where an individual comes into possession of the item.
I'm not asking you what it generally refers to. I'm asking what it means.
It means that you come into the property or the issue at item.
What is the legal definition of converted?
That's what I'm trying to explain. That the
I don't think you know.
An individual comes into possession of an item entirely legally and that with consent of the owner, and then later
That's not true. Look, if you steal something and you're sued civilly, you're sued for conversion, which is the civil term for theft.
It all goes back to the way that the
Now, maybe converted has some special meaning in criminal law. That's what I'm asking you. It has some definition that's different from taken by fraud.
Well, here it has to have a separate definition from stolen or taken by fraud because of the way that the statute was structured. I agree with you.
Look. Statutes often use synonyms. They're worried someone may find some definition in a dictionary and argue that it means something different. It creates a loophole. But I don't know what the difference is between converted. You would ordinarily describe this person, he's a receiver of stolen property, right?
I agree with you that these terms are similar to each other. They all refer to different ways in which property can be wrongfully taken. In this case, Congress chose to structure the statute to specifically enumerate that the property at issue here is property that has been stolen.
This is a statute about the receiver, and from the receiver's standpoint, the way in which it was stolen, whether it was stolen by false pretenses or by fraud, is totally irrelevant.
If it were totally irrelevant, then it can't be, just based on the structure of the of the statute and the language used.
Synonyms, then there's no problem.
Under basic tenets of statutory construction, we cannot
come on.
Read.
Are you saying there are no redundancies in statutes?
I'm not saying that here. But if you look at the case
law,
if
there are redundancies in statutes, maybe this is an example of them.
Looking at the case law out of the D.C. Circuit, U.S. versus Sayan, we had a similar issue. There the indictment only alleged taken by fraud, but the jury was allowed to be instructed that the property could have been stolen, converted, or taken by fraud. The court there did not find a constructive amendment because it found a match between the evidence that was presented.
They left out the fraud, right?
They instructed the jury on all three, but they only alleged on one.
The indictment here, it left out the third term, right? Taken
Correct.
By fraud?
Yes.
Well, that made it harder, right? That made it harder because stealing is worse than taking by fraud. So it's actually harder for the jury to indict. So how could your client possibly be harmed by the omission of taken by fraud?
Well, he was harmed because the allegation that the evidence presented at trial and the theory that the government went on with trial was not passed on by the grand jury.
Well, but when we look at the jury instruction, because you alluded to this other case, the jury instruction in the Natur situation said that the goods were taken by false pretenses, trickery, or misrepresentation. That was the language used in the jury fraud,
Correct.
In the jury charge. And, of course, those would equal taken by fraud, right?
Yes. And
okay. So the jury was given the standard that they needed to weigh the evidence in terms of the defendant's behavior.
Right, and that's the problem, because here the jury instruction broadened the theory under which Mr. Natur could be charged. If it had been alleged...
And so and then the question is, then how did that harm him? How did that broadening harm him so that the case would have been tried differently if there had been notice that this language was going to be given in the jury instruction?
Right. I'm not addressing the issue of notice. He was harmed because under the Constitution, he had a right to have all felony charges passed against the grand jury. The grand jury is a step between an insurance that makes sure the government is not overreaching. Here, the indictment could have been drafted. The government could have just simply mirrored the language in the statute, and they didn't for
Mr.
whatever
Mazzica,
reason.
Are you familiar with a case out of the Court of Appeals from the Fifth Circuit called Litta, United States against Litta?
Yes.
And how do you distinguish that?
I distinguish that because, so there the indictment alleged only stolen. And the court characterized the activity as embezzlement. The court did not address the adjacent terms of converted and taken by fraud that are in 2314, but they did note that the presence of those terms were relevant. And that's what we are saying
here.
What
do they mean by relevant?
Relevant, that they must have some separate and distinct meaning, that the term stolen cannot be allowed to just swallow converted and taken by...
What did the court have to say about the word steal?
They took the definition of stolen and used the definition that was from 2312, which is a very broad definition of stolen. And I think actually looking at 2312 in relationship to 2314 is very important here. 2314 was drafted after 2312. It was meant to be an extension of 2312. Congress could have simply, again, mirrored the language that they used in 2312, used the single term stolen with a broad definition. Instead, at getting at property other than motor vehicles...
was dealing with property other than motor vehicles.
Yes.
And wouldn't it be entirely possible that Congress simply wanted to make clear that those other kinds of property which were more susceptible to embezzlement and fraud were in fact, if those activities were in fact included within the ambit of the statute?
Yes. And that's why these terms now must mean something different, that they're not all assumed under one.
The court didn't give any special meaning to steal.
The Lida court? They took the definition from 2312.
As a general definition?
Yes.
And so why wouldn't... What's the harm? I guess I'm having problem. Basically, the general person who violates 2314 doesn't always know how the goods became hot. He just knows they're hot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you expect them to do some kind of a title search to find out how the goods became hot? That seems to be your position.
No, that's not my position.
He knows they belong, they're in somebody's hands other than the true owner. And that's probably all they know. and are going to be told.
You know, the government has a duty to indict and present its evidence accordingly. Here, the evidence and the jury instruction broadened what the government alleged.
But it's complete surplusage to the gravamen of the offense, which is transporting hot goods, goods that don't belong to you across state lines, right?
Yes, it does all get at wrongful takings. But there are different ways of wrongful takings, and under basic tenets of statutory construction.
You've got to get around that word steal, don't you, and the fact that it was imported from 2312.
Yes, it has a different meaning.
You've got to give me an explanation as to Congress having assigned some special meaning to that word in 2314.
Well, I think just based on the structure of the statute, and that within the same clause, they enumerate three different types of property: stolen, converted,
or
taken by fraud.
Really, basically, is we have to accept a canon of statutory construction. Right?
Yes. Yes.
And that's your whole case.
Yes.
One way to put what I think Judge Ripple is suggesting is that, building on his point, that ordinarily the receiver doesn't know the precise way in which the property was appropriated from its true owner. This is just to say it doesn't really. You don't have to know the specifics of how it got it of how this property was appropriated, whether it's stolen, converted, taken by fraud. That covers the whole waterfront. That doesn't mean that the distinctions among them are relevant to the receiver's liability. Let me ask you on the harm dimension of this case. Suppose the indictment said that he had received cell phones that had been stolen from small children.
Okay.
But the evidence showed that actually, no, these were all obtained from adults. So would you say that the indictment had been constructively amended?
No, because that's not an essential element of the offense. The offense prescribes the interstate transportation of property worth over $5,000 that's either been stolen, converted, or taken by fraud. This isn't a case where they allege that these were Verizon cell phones and they turned out to be Sprint cell phones. That's not an essential element of the case.
That wouldn't be relevant.
Right.
No.
Just as who the phones came from would not be relevant.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ms. Kim?
May it please the Court, Nicole Kim for the United States. Neither the evidence presented at the trial nor the instructions given to the jury constructively amended the indictment because the jury was properly instructed without objection from the defendant. Using the definition of stolen established by the Supreme Court in U.S. v. Turley and recognizing the Seventh Circuit pattern instruction and the evidence proved conduct that fell well within this well-established definition.
What do you do with your sister's argument about statutory construction? 2314, there are two other ways that the goods could have become hot.
Well, in Turley, the Supreme Court defined that word stolen as any felonious taking with the intent to deprive the owner of the rights and benefits of ownership. It specifically rejected the defendant's argument that embezzlement wasn't included within the term stolen because embezzlement wasn't listed in the statute. It found that stolen, the first term of the statute, was a broad term. It was meant to be overlapping because the purpose of the statute was to cover all kinds of ways that property could be deprived from its rightful owner. And so the overlapping terms make sense given what the statute meant to criminalize. So the evidence in this case fell within that well-established definition. That evidence included the defendant's own admission that he bought phones from a guy named Andre. He knew that Andre was obtaining phones illegally by ordering them in the name of a phony business and then intending to default on payments and then selling the phones on the cheap to the defendant.
Let me ask you about the Dowling case. Didn't the Supreme Court hold that stolen doesn't reach bootleg records? How do we reconcile that case with your interpretation of the word stolen?
That stolen didn't reach bootleg records.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is distinguishable from this case, because here all that we had to show was that the defendant shipped the goods knowing that they were obtained unlawfully, not specifically that he knew the precise circumstances in which the goods were obtained or who they belonged to or what kind of ownership interest that it had and how it was initially deprived. I think given that definition of stolen and the evidence of his conduct that fell within that definition, it's our position that that instruction was proper.
What if someone asks a friend to borrow a very expensive computer for a month but takes the computer out of state, doesn't intend to return it until a year later? Would that computer be stolen or taken by fraud? Is there a distinction?
I don't believe there would be a distinction, because the intent of that person would still be to deprive. He knew that the computer rightfully belonged to another person, and the intent was to deprive that owner of his use and rights and benefits of ownership in that computer. So there would not be a difference. Going back to the evidence, and this also goes to the defendant's sufficiency of evidence argument, there was also evidence that in his post-arrest interview, when he was asked whether the phones were stolen, that the defendant admitted that he knew what he was doing was illegal. He also lied to a FedEx employee about the contents of one of his shipments, saying that they contained electronic motherboards rather than cell phones. So the jury was presented with all this evidence. It was sufficient for them to find, based on the evidence, that A, the phones were stolen, and B, that the defendant knew them when he shipped them. In addition, the district court did not commit clear error in finding that the reasonable estimate of the loss for guideline purposes was the retail value of the phones in the defendant's counts of conviction. And that is because the amount of Sprint adjustments in this case, which is approximately $104,000, did not reflect the total loss caused by the offense.
Your opponent argued that the judge shouldn't have found that he was engaged in a stolen property business. And now, he was in that business, if that's what we want to call it, but he engaged in this criminal activity for 5 months, is that correct?
The charged shipments, he was involved with over the course of approximately 3 weeks.
Pardon?
Approximately 3 weeks. That conduct involved in the indictment.
Right. No, but I mean the total activity that on which the probation office based its recommendation.
There was evidence that he was involved about 5 to 6 months prior to his arrest in buying and selling stolen phones.
I see. So it was the arrest that terminated his activity. Is that right?
Yes.
So is the government's argument, you didn't spend much time on your brief, is the government's argument that he would have continued in this business of selling stolen cell phones if he hadn't been caught?
Yes, I think naturally that would have resulted from his arrest. He wouldn't.
Did he testify that he was about to get out of it, or it was just a 5 month thing? Or
a defendant did not testify. But he did, in his post-arrest statement, acknowledge that he had customers, some of the same customers that received the phones and the charge shipments, that he had been dealing with them over a substantial period of time, that sold them, I think, one customer in New York who received 4 of the 5 charge shipments. The defendant admitted that he sent to that customer about 1,500 phones. And also, when we checked the bank records for the New York customer, it showed that there was approximately $350,000 in checks written to the defendant's business. So just going back to the last amount very quickly, to summarize, the spread adjustments wasn't an accurate reflection of the total loss caused by the offense. Sprint's loss was not limited to the price that it charged to the customers, which was what was reflected in the adjustment amount. So on that basis, the retail value, or in this case, the manufacturer's suggested retail price, was a better estimate of a loss than the adjustments. And therefore, the loss amount for guideline purposes was not outside the realm of permissible computations. The district court also adequately explained the loss amount in its decision. It noted that the retail value was a fair value, a fair measure of damages in this case.
I'm looking at that right now on page 30 of the sentencing transcript. And is it clear the district judge was following the discussion of counsel at all at this point? She seems to go back and forth from using the MSRP to worrying about the discount price that Sprint was charging people. It's very hard to follow.
I think the court did have some difficulty in trying to determine exactly who suffered the loss, and that sort of carried over into the discussion about what the amount should be. But I think
sounds more like a law school study session than it does a district court sentencing somebody.
I think one of the reasons why this discussion took place was because the alternative figures that were presented by the defendant were speculative. The defense presented sort of alternative loss theories and suggested that the loss amount should be reduced by the lower price of phones that are normally sold with service contracts, or potentially reduced by the resale value that Sprint could have had by reselling the recovered phones. But those figures were all speculative. It did not have support.
What did she mean when the district court said they have more than an approximation on a third of those phones? Sounds like she's talking about the phones where we knew there was some kind of a discount.
Well, the third of the phones, I believe she was referring to the Sprint adjustment amount, which was approximately 100.
Which is the amount you maintain she wasn't going to use.
Correct.
And then, you know, a couple of lines down now, she says the government's 300-some thousand minus the 50 phones or whatever it was, 55 phones. I doubt that it makes any big difference, but maybe it does. I don't know. I mean, what's she coming to rest on here?
I think she referenced the $104,000 figure as the minimum amount that Sprint had to pay. They had to pay back at least that, and so she recognized that the loss was higher. The court actually took a conservative estimate of the loss, and it specifically acknowledged the government's calculation. I don't recall the specific page, but it is in the transcript. It acknowledged the government's calculation, but then backed out the value of the phones that were in the count that was dismissed by the government. So even though it reads like she's going back and forth, I think given the totality of the record and the evidence that was before the court, it had enough to sufficiently determine.
I think you used the phrase totality of the record in the brief, if I'm not mistaken. I remember at least figuratively going through the roof when I read it. I mean, am I supposed to sit there to decide from the totality of the record what the district court is using as the operative figure in sentencing the man?
No, I think
you should have served it up. Tell me.
In this particular case, the court did, as I said, specifically acknowledge the government's calculation of the loss amount and specifically stated that, for guideline purposes, it was that minus the value of the phones and count four.
It seems to me when this happens, it's the government's obligation to make a record for the appeal. Say, Your Honor, can you state explicitly what you're doing so we have the record on the appeal? We've got, you know, pages of a nice little conversation here that goes on and on and on. And frankly, it's gibberish.
I think if you parse out certain parts of the court's discussion, it is clear that it did explain what the loss amount was and what it based its decision on.
But even she accepted the government's estimate of the loss wholesale, even though the government's estimate included phones that Stock testified could not be traced to any loss to Sprint.
That was our position at sentencing because the evidence showed that the phones in all five shipments, including the counts that the government dismissed, the evidence showed that all the phones were stolen, all 708 phones. As I said, the court, when it backed out the value of the phones in count four, was taking a more conservative approach to the loss amount and coming up with a lower figure. If I can just very quickly address that the evidence that the district court had before it when it considered the in-the-business enhancement, it also adequately explained its decision to apply it. The court emphasized that the defendant was involved in the theft of a significant number of phones. It noted that theft was a huge societal problem. It also noted that the defendant had a legitimate business, but then that did not preclude him from having an illegal business on the side.
I should note, Ms. Kim, you were not the attorney for the government who tried this case, were you?
I was one of the attorneys at trial, Your Honor.
You were not the one involved in the sentencing colloquy, though.
I was not present at sentencing. That's correct. And for those reasons, we ask that the court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Kim. So, Ms. Ruzicka, does she have any time? No. Okay. We'll move on to our next case. And we thank you. You were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of the client.